are now listening to the UR Quadcast, University of Rochester's official podcast.
Welcome to the Quadcast. I'm joined today by University of Rochester psychology professor Judy Smetana, an expert in the field of adolescent-parent relationships, and Wendy Rote, who got her PhD in psychology at Rochester and is now an assistant professor at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Sandra.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Judy, let's start with you. Both of you just recently co-authored a study about guilt, and more specifically about children's and teens' feelings and thoughts about parents using guilt as a parenting tool. And the concept of guilt is a bit controversial in your field. Can you explain why?
Well, it's primarily because there are two different research literatures on guilt. So there's research from the parenting literature where guilt is seen as a negative parenting practice. In that literature, guilt is seen as psychologically controlling, intrusive, and as negative for children's development. On the other hand, in the moral development literature, guilt is seen as a positive parenting practice, and it's seen as a good way to help children internalize their parents' moral values. So what's key here, though, is really that the two literatures, or the important difference, is in how they conceptualize guilt.
Wendy, how does your study address this particular controversy about guilt?
Well, in my study, I tried to delve deeper into the different situations in which guilt might be positive or negative. I focused on three different elements. One is what parents are making kids feel bad about or guilty about, particularly moral issues, whether they hurt someone else, and that we found to be relatively acceptable. Kids tended to view that relatively positively, or personal issues, things like what activities were the kids involved with, and kids there tended to find it relatively unacceptable for parents to induce guilt about those types of issues. I also looked at whether parents focused on just the child's behavior or criticized the child as a person, and there, kids actually didn't seem to notice that it was more problematic. They didn't find it less acceptable, but they felt much worse about themselves when parents criticized them as people. And then finally, I looked at whether it made a difference if the parent focuses on the correct victim, the person who really got hurt, or kind of indirect effects for the parent, making them feel bad. And here, again, kids and teens were noticing that difference, and they focused on it being much more acceptable and positively motivated when parents focused on the correct victim, the person who really got hurt.
Wendy, can you describe the setup for your guilt study?
Sure. What I did is I created some hypothetical scenarios, some stories where I had teens or children involved in different behaviors, different kinds of behaviors, and then I had parents respond to those behaviors in the stories, and I asked kids and teens to rate how they think the story character would feel before the parent's response, after the parent's response, and then to rate the parent's response itself, whether it was acceptable, whether it was effective at preventing that behavior in the future, and then also what types of motives they thought underlay the parent's guilt induction.
When you looked specifically at scenarios in which guilt works and where it's actually detrimental to the child or the young teen, and I think you addressed that a little bit already. So in other words, if a parent says, you shouldn't do that because it makes me look bad, that's not particularly an effective way of guilting a child, correct?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. It does seem to be effective at making the child feel guilty, but you're right. It's definitely not effective at making the child feel like they don't want to do it again, or that it's acceptable. They're going to think that the parent was kind of negatively motivated.
So, Wendy, what's the takeaway for parents? To guilt or not to guilt?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it does depend a bit, but the big takeaway is it's important to save your guilt induction for situations in which the child's behavior really hurt other people. And when and if you do induce guilt, to do it mainly in ways that only criticize the child's behavior, not the child as a person. And also, that younger kids, so I looked at ages 8 to 17 in my study, younger kids were more accepting of guilt induction, whereas older teens tended to really kind of negatively evaluate it more. So you also have to be conscious of your child's age in this whole process and whether they are okay with you kind of trying to exert your feelings that way.
Okay, show of hands, who actually here has children? Okay, so you can't see that, but Judy just gave me a show of hands. So Judy, as the researcher, you know one thing. As a parent, you may or may not do what you know. Did you ever guilt your kids?
I'm sure I did, but I definitely tried to stay away from it. So I think there are other methods of discipline and other parenting practices that are more effective. So yeah, I definitely try not to guilt my kids.
Judy, we want to hear more about good parenting practices. And you have written extensively about adolescent parent conflict, also known to some parents as the Sturm und Drang of their teenagers. What can you tell us about that?
So I think the notion of Sturm und Drang is definitely overplayed. Generally, research shows that the nature of adolescent-parent relationships is fairly similar from childhood to adolescence. So if you have good, warm, close relationships during childhood, that's likely to continue into adolescence. There are some changes, though, in that there's an increase in the frequency of conflicts or disagreements between adolescents and parents. And that's because adolescence is a really important time for the development of autonomy, and adolescents are trying to gain more independence sometimes than parents want them to have.
And this is where the door banging comes in, the door slamming. Now, there was a line in your research, Judy, that I thought that sort of just epitomized what I was looking at, which is sort of the adolescent parent conflicts are, you write, at their heart, debates of where to draw the line between parental control and authority on one side and then the adolescent's autonomy over the self on the other side. So what do parents and teens agree upon and where do they generally disagree?
Actually, there are large areas of agreement and also some boundary issues that cause a fair amount of disagreement. So in general, parents and adolescents agree that parents should be able to make rules and set limits about issues that have to do with adolescent safety and well-being. So keeping them safe and healthy is really important to parents, and teens generally agree with that notion. They also generally agree that parents have the authority to make rules about social norms or appropriate behavior. On the other hand, parents and teens agree that adolescents should have some privacy, control over their bodies, and control over personal issues, things like their hobbies, their personal tastes, how they look, what they're reading, what TV shows they watch, or who their friends should be. But parents and teens generally disagree about where to draw the line between things that pertain to well-being and safety and things that should be up to teens to control. So teens generally think many more things are personal and should be up to them than parents think they do. And that's really where conflicts arise, how to draw the boundaries between protecting teens and keeping them safe and allowing them some sphere or realm where they have personal choice. So in the examples I gave you, things like, you know, some of these things that we treat as personal choice may be fairly benign, what TV shows to watch and so on. On the other hand, if movies or TV have too much sexual content or are too violent, parents may no longer think that they're personal, but may think that they're something they should regulate. So that's where conflicts tend to bubble up.
Wendy, I'd like to open it up to you again. Where does one draw the line between control and autonomy?
Well, I agree that a lot of the important thing is to focus on what is going to keep the adolescent safe and what you can kind of give a little on while allow them that area of control while still maintaining the really important things to you as a parent and to your child's safety. One of the other things that we find within the literature is that what's very important is slowly providing more control to teens as they age. So just as important as finding a good middle ground and drawing the line somewhere is relaxing that line over time and giving older teens more personal control than you provide to younger teens.
And Judy, I can see you're ready to jump in on this one.
I agree with everything Wendy said. But I think one of the things that makes it difficult is that, first of all, a lot depends on your own teen and how responsible they are and their personality and so on. But the other thing is that there really is no firm line. And it's clear that adolescents' autonomy is changing and expanding during adolescence, and parents need to be aware of that and sort of in tune with that balance at that moment or at that point in time with how much control is appropriate versus how much autonomy you can give your teen. And also keep revisiting those boundaries as adolescents get older and, you know, depending on the maturity and how they've handled the new privileges and responsibilities they may be granted, sort of see how that's going and move forward slowly and carefully.
I was going to pick up on something you said a little earlier, Judy. You said most parents agree that it falls into the child's domain to decide about looks. And I understand that there are lots of areas of overlapping. So I'm thinking if my 14-year-old comes to me and says, I want a nose ring and I want a pierced tongue, yes, that's her look. But boy, do I have something to say about that.
That is a great example of how these boundary issues can be so difficult to negotiate. So there's so many aspects of appearance that we think are fairly trivial, their personal taste. And then there are these areas that are highly contentious. And so really that's where the difficulty comes in. That's where conflicts arise. And there's no one answer that fits all. You know, that really is up to parents' feelings about those things, their view of the health and health risks involved in those things. I should say that my son has an eyebrow piercing. He spent a semester in Denmark studying abroad and came home with it. And I have to say, I was not very happy about it.
I was going to say, how much did you not use guilt at that moment in your response?
Well, I knew it was way too late to do anything. He preempted the discussion and he was an adult when he did it, and he still has it. So,
are there any other strategies you want parents to know about when they negotiate this territory of control and autonomy?
Well, I would say there's several strategies. Communication, communication, communication. So I think the most important thing is that the lines of communication really have to be open. So parents need to provide guidance. They need to provide structure for their teens. They need to provide clear rationales for the kinds of rules and expectations that they have. But I think they really have to listen to their teens. And I think that's often very hard for parents to do. One of the things that we've learned in our research is that adolescents and parents have very different views of some of these issues. And as we've been discussing, parents often see an issue of conflict as one of safety or their teen's well-being or of following established social norms, family or community norms. And it's likely that the teen views that same issue in a very different way. So they tend to think about things as, you know, it's my choice, it's up to me, it's my room, you don't have a right to tell me to do that. And it's really important, even if parents make the final decision, that they listen to their teens, respect their opinion, even if they don't want to negotiate the issue.
When you say a teen may say, that's up to me, that's my domain, that gets us to another topic, which is spying on your kids. When I phrase it like that, I think most of us will say, oh gosh, no, that's a terrible thing to do. On the other hand, I think given the option of sort of implanting some kind of little device in the back of their necks and so you know where they are at all times, I think a lot of parents would jump at that opportunity. So Wendy, if you want to take a stab at this first, do parents have a right to know what their teens are up to? And at the same time, don't they have a duty to keep their children safe? So how much asking and maybe even snooping is okay?
Well, so I completely agree that parents absolutely have a right to know what their teens are up to. However, we find that it's most important that they're direct about that right and about the reasons that they want to know things. And that the best way of finding out about what teens are up to is having your teen tell you him or herself. And that snooping in particular is a really problematic strategy. It undermines trust within the relationship. It tends to make teens in particular feel very intruded upon, very reactive, much more likely to not disclose to their parents in the future or even to lie about things. And so although parents have this right to know, they have to, again, communicate and negotiate with their teens about why they want to know. And teens do respect their parents' right to regulate things, especially when those are issues of safety. And so if parents can explain their position and try to listen to their teen and find a negotiation strategy where the teen is willing to tell them some things, that's much preferable.
I just wanted to highlight, again, the importance of good communication. So we do know that having your child tell you what they're up to is the best way to monitor them, to keep track of what they're doing. But that really depends on having a good, healthy relationship. So the more you can establish that sort of trust and warmth and responsiveness in the relationship, the more likely they are to tell you what they're doing or keep you in the loop. And so that takes a great deal of trust on the part of the parent, but also a great deal of trust on the part of the child that their, you know, needs are going to be respected.
And I guess as the child, as you find generally that your child is doing what you want him or her to do, there's less of a need to snoop.
Well, I would say that if you need to snoop, that probably there's some problems in the relationship. So we know that snooping is intrusive, that it's almost always interpreted negatively on the part of the child, and it's probably a last resort for many parents. So I think before they snoop, they should sort of back up and think about other ways, other strategies, other ways they can negotiate their relationship so that becomes unnecessary.
So, for example, would you say to parents, ask straight out, if you have a question, a concern, or maybe even an inkling that your child may be, and I'm picking an example, doing drugs, rather than searching the entire room for paraphernalia, go directly to the child and say, are you doing drugs?
Well, the research on asking directly, technically people talk about that as soliciting information, is kind of mixed. There's some evidence that asking kids directly is negative, but I think that's because parents tend to resort to that primarily when they already suspect their child's in trouble. So I think one has to be careful in saying, yes, always confront your child. But I think that's preferable to snooping.
So you were already talking about preferable behavior on the parents' part. So let's then talk a little bit about best practices for parents and also educators when it comes to dealing with adolescents in their natural quest for greater autonomy. What would you tell them?
A lot of this has to start in childhood, that it depends on the quality of the relationship between parents and children. So it's really important to establish a warm, trusting, responsive relationship with your child before they hit adolescence so that you have a firm basis on which to proceed. So being warm and responsive doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have rules and standards and have high expectations for your children. And in fact, I think that doing so, having firm rules, making your expectations clear, providing rationales are really, that along with responsiveness will take parents a long way towards sort of getting through some of the speed bumps of adolescence. Beyond that, I think it's really important to take the time to listen to adolescents, understand their point of view, even if you disagree. We have done some studies in our lab where we brought parents and adolescents into the lab and asked them in interviews to talk about issues of conflict in their relationships, and then to sit down together and to discuss them. And one of the really surprising parts of that research was how often parents said they never actually had had those discussions before, and how insightful it was for them to actually give each side a chance to express their point of view. So I think there needs to be more of those kinds of discussions in parent-adolescent relationships. On a different note, I think it's really important that adolescents know that you're there for them. So adolescence is a really difficult time for teens. They're going through a lot of biological changes, the physiological changes of puberty. They may be transitioning into middle school and then high school. They're dealing with peer pressures and desires to be liked by their peers. They're beginning romantic relationships. So a lot going on in their lives beyond what's going on at home. And I think it's really important that teenagers know that their parents are there for them, that they've got their back. And I think parents also have to remember that even when their kid, you know, storms out of the room, calls them names, says that they're the worst parents they could ever imagine, that that's not really true. The kids still love them, and that kids are listening even when you think they're ignoring your advice.
Now, what about what you read in the parenting books for little toddlers, where it says, pick your battles, don't sweat the small stuff? Does any of that apply also to your teens?
I think that's exactly right. I think that part of what we're talking about here is that the development of autonomy develops over a lot of the small stuff. So one of the biggest issues of adolescent-parent conflict is the state of the adolescent's room, whether they keep it clean or how it's decorated. Well, I would say that, you know, parents have lots of good reasons. Parents say the room's part of the house, or I'm teaching them to be responsible. But in the scheme of things, I would say that's one of the small things. You know, maybe it's okay to let that one go and focus on other more important things. So I think it's, you know, thinking about areas where you can grant them autonomy, where it's safe to do so, where they can express their uniqueness and their selves while keeping them safe. So try to think about the areas where, you know, really let them do that. My son actually, for a while, my younger son, had police tape taped over the door of his room, you know, keep out tape, which I personally found very offensive, but we let it go.
Is that the one with the earring?
No, that's the other one.
Well, I'm taking copious notes, and I think you'll be getting a thank you note from my 13-year-old daughter, who also thinks that her room is clean when I disagree. So I think I'm going to chalk this up now.
If there are no rats, no.
Not that I know.
No bugs.
So, okay, small stuff, so I should just let it go. All right, good. I'm learning something. Then what is the steer clear list? So obviously, let that one go. Wendy, do you want to jump in here? Steer clear list? What really should you not do if you want to have a good relationship with your adolescent, with your teenagers?
Well, one of those things I would say is try to be respectful of the areas in which the teen has asserted their authority. And again, like Judy said, that maybe you can let go. So if, you know, if you've talked with them and you've had a conversation and they've really expressed reasons why they believe that they should be able to dress a certain way or that they want to keep their room in a certain style, being respectful of that and acknowledging those feelings, I think can go a long way towards improving communication and having teens be more open to other areas in which maybe parents have more of a right to assert their authority. It's sort of the idea that, you know, okay, if you're not trying to control me in everything, maybe there's a reason you're actually trying to put your foot down about this or that. And again, communicating, just like Judy says, that's so important. And recognizing that your teen is listening. I actually wanted to bring in, I'm currently doing a study where I'm bringing in parents and teens. They're talking about issues of guilt, and we have them reflect upon how they think their partner felt during the discussion. And we find often that parents will say, oh, my teen doesn't feel guilty. They're not feeling guilty about these things. But when you look at what the teens say, they're saying, oh no, I'm feeling guilty. I'm listening. I'm hearing what parents are saying, and it matters to me.
Another thing I'd like to add is that I think it's really important. I think it's fine for parents to show their emotions, but you know, when we're dealing with highly reactive or aggressive kids, one of the pieces of advice or one of the things people do with interventions is sort of take a breath, count to 10 before you act. So I would say the same thing to parents when they get upset at something their teen does, to take a breath, count to 10, and think about how they want to respond. Because we know from some of the research on disclosure and secrecy that how parents respond when they hear that their teen has done something or hasn't told them where they're going or done something that makes them unhappy, that the way parents respond really affects whether they sort of open up and talk more about the issue or really shut down and become more unwilling to communicate with their parents. So I think the advice that we give to children about regulating their emotions also can be very valuable for parents in terms of not overreacting, you know, saying, you did what? You know, just kind of chill for a minute and modulate a little bit.
Thank you so much. Lots of good advice, lots of food for thought here. Thank you, Professors Wendy Rote and Judy Smetana, for the interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the University of Rochester's Quadcast, I'm Sandra Knispel. Thanks for listening.